Alan, we heard earlier, I think it was Peter that mentioned it, who's just unfortunately had to go, that the current Secretary of State for Trade has two obsessions. One obsession is that of free ports, and the second obsession is to sign a free trade agreement with the United States. Mm-hmm. Let me set aside to one moment how easy or difficult that might be. I'll come on to that. But imagine that we could sign a deal, a good deal in inverted commas, with the United States. How good a deal could, how important could that be for the UK? Is it important for us to try and sign a deal with the US?
So it depends what you mean by good, I suppose. So how good could it get?
How good could it get?
Yeah, so President Trump said it would quadruple or more the amount of trade, times four, that the UK does with the USA. And the permanent secretary of the Department of International Trade retweeted that tweet. So it's British sort of policy and a British view now. This is completely deluded. There is more or less no chance that we would even get a deal that doubled trade. Now, why is that? The UK and the US are both pretty liberal economies. All right, we already let each other's stuff in, pretty much. Where we don't let each other's stuff in, it's partly because we have different regulatory regimes. The Food and Drug Administration in the US and the sort of Drug Administration here, NICE, and so on. Financial services regulated one way in the US, regulated another way in the Bank of England. Regulators are very conservative. They're there to protect people from harm happening, so they move very slowly. So in the big, big things that we could trade with each other, in a sense, it's almost inconceivable that we would be able to harmonize our regulations with them. Add to that that the US is 3,000 miles away at least, go to Chicago, it's further, go to the West Coast, it's even further. And we know the effects of trade agreements sort of erode over space. So the long and the short of it is, in terms of numbers, my guess is it would be more or less inconceivable that we could double the amount of trade that we do with the States. Now, that is a significant amount of extra trade. The United States takes 15% of our exports, so double it, 30%, that's a big, big hit. And so that would be, I think, you know, quite a big boost, and imports coming the other way. So I think actually it's probably less than double, but I would never go more than double.
Okay, now let me move on to the second part of the question, which is, how easy is it going to be to get such a deal?
Oh, getting such a deal as that, I think, is going to be extraordinarily hard. Not least because when Donald J. Trump says he's going to quadruple trade with the UK, he means the UK is going to buy four times more from America. He doesn't mean that America is going to buy four times more from the UK. So there's a sort of whole political issue. The Americans have always been very, very hard negotiators in trade agreements. It's partly to do with, I suppose, their attitude towards business, but also partly to do with the political structures, the way they go about signing trade agreements. They extract a great deal. Add to that, we're only going to sign an agreement with the US if we have a Brexit that is pretty much a hard Brexit. If we have a Brexit that leaves us very closely aligned with the European Union, as Trump has said, there won't be much room for a trade agreement with the US. So that's also going to be difficult. And if we have a hard Brexit, all the people who hate the idea of a hard Brexit will turn to hate a US-UK agreement. The Democrats have said they won't agree to a trade agreement with the UK that doesn't honour the Good Friday Agreement. And although you might argue that what Trumpson has negotiated with the EU is sort of honours a Good Friday Agreement, you can't help feeling it is not going to do the Northern Irish economy much good, as you pointed out. So I think there'll be sort of, there's huge enthusiasm in principle, and there'll be a lot of resistance in detail. So I think it'll be hard.
And then I can't resist the question, should we worry about the NHS in such a deal?
Oh yes, we should. So well, I think we should worry about it in the following sense. there is no way that the NHS going free to your GP is under threat. That's just not on offer. It's clearly carved out of all trade agreements. However, the US has made it one of its objectives to remove regulations that unnecessarily hinder US exports and hinder the exploitation of US intellectual property. And that is, I mean, the conversation now in the media seems to, in my view, arrive at more or less the right place. That's about drug pricing. The American companies, drug companies, absolutely hate the fact that they have to deal with a big, strong, single purchaser in the UK who can say, unless you sell it to us at that price, you don't sell anything at all. It's a, you would say, a bilateral monopoly. And in that respect, I think on drug pricing, that is almost certainly. I think it is almost certainly the case that on other things which the National Health Service already puts out to the private sector, the Americans will get better access to being able to bid for that as well. 6% of NHS goes out to private sector. My own view on that, I have to say, I'm really very worried about drug pricing, on the idea that an American company would provide health services that the NHS buys in rather than G4S. It's not something that keeps me awake. I think, you know, one bunch of capitalists are pretty much like another. So I think it's, you know, it's not nearly as bad as the NHS is completely undermined, but it equally well is not going to turn out to be the case that nothing happens to the NHS at all. Big Pharma in the US will not let the American government sign a trade agreement that doesn't have something in it for them.
Great, thank you. Right, any questions? Yes, over there.
Okay, I'm a doctor, so I have very little economic knowledge. Surely the ERG have some economists, and unless they're completely just idealistic, they have some economists backing them. What on earth do they think is going to happen?
Yes. Well, the economists who back the ERG, what should we say, are an eccentric fringe. The entire mainstream and even people who aren't mainstream but are not way out pretty much agree that the economic analysis on which the ERG group bases its policies is pretty flawed. It is also pretty ideological. The idea, the attraction of Singapore on Thames, which we were talking about earlier, exactly aligns with the Institute for Economic Affairs, the IEA, set up in the 1930s as a right-wing think tank, basically. And so they are very comfortable with the idea that actually all you do is let markets work. And they probably, if we bought them a couple of drinks, they would probably tell us that no, it is bad that the National Health Service exercises its monopsony power, its power as the single buyer of drugs, because that will discourage innovation and discourage the supply of drugs. So I think there is both some funny economics, but also a very, very particular way of the way, a view of the way the world should be.
Can I just come in on that? Yes, the ERG, as Alan has rightly said, do have some economists that work with them and so on. But it really is the case that the views and their analyses are very much at one end of the spectrum. There's a lot of other economic analysis that has been done out there, and none of it agrees with what the economists of the ERG are saying. It is really quite eccentric.
So this leads to a deeper question, and you're free to say no to it. But what's happened to modern rhetoric? How is it that there are groups of people who are able to maintain a space in modern political discourse which is fringe and yet act as if they are mainstream?
Oh gosh. I mean I think, you know, it says, well, it's a big question and one need a lot of time to think about it. Think about some, one of the things which the whole of sort of media regulation and certainly academia has come to recognise is that the notions that public service broadcasting should have even-handed treatment during the referendum actually seriously misfired, because they would have one of the 99.5% of economists who thought one way, and every time they had to be matched by an ERG economist. You could name them probably if you thought hard, because you heard them on the radio and the box, on the television so much. So I think that's one of the things. We also have got into, I suppose, if I'm old enough to say this, yeah, we've got into a sort of post-truth version that no longer people seem to be very embarrassed by somebody else picking holes in their argument. It seems to be sufficient to say, well, to insult them and say, yeah, oh no, you worked once for the European Commission, so I don't have to believe anything that you say, for instance. So I think the rhetoric in the sort of correct use of the term about the construction of the argument has changed, that things, counter-arguments that we used 20 years ago, we would just say, that's not the way we settle these things. We do it analytically and based on evidence and fact. Now it works perfectly well, and you know, the personal insults and so on.
I'm thinking about dead in a ditch, for example. That would have excluded candidates previously.
True.
Now we have a politician who's in charge of the country who already believes he should be dead in a ditch.
No, he never believes in the first place. Give the man some credit. He knew what he was saying. No, I absolutely agree. But I think that, you know, one of the reasons that, in a sense, well, it's happened, it's not just with Brexit that we see that this fringe has been quietened down, in a sense. It's also happened on climate. Whereas, you know, 3 years ago, the BBC thought, you know, for every climate scientist, they had to put on a climate denier. They no longer think that. So I think we have come, you know, a little bit of a distance on that. But I think it is the fact that, you know, in a sense, it's how do you feel, how many followers have you got on Twitter, not actually have you thought this through. Everything is so immediate as well, and everything has to be fitted into 140 characters or something like that. And all of that has led, you know, to the erosion of the sort of ways that we as academics are used to conducting arguments, which is to stare at the ceiling for 3 minutes and say, come back next year, I'll have an answer.
I would also add to that that I think that the arguments about the economic effects of Brexit have not been the most important in people's minds. What has been most important has been the sort of political sovereignty, taking back control arguments. Okay, there might be a little bit of economic loss, but actually, you know, we want sovereignty. And it's been much easier in that climate for politicians to tell untruths, and people don't mind that they're telling porcupines, that they're telling lies, as long as they think they're delivering kind of what they want, which is the politics.
You're
yes.
saying that when you go to government, or people you're talking to in government, and you put these views across, are they just saying, thank you very much, we don't get?
They don't generally invite us.
When we talk to government, a lot of the work that we do when we do talk to government is not necessarily to the politicians, but working with the civil servants.
Yeah.
Civil servants, lots of extremely highly qualified, really good civil servants, who understand all these arguments perfectly, but they're not the ones making the decisions.
Yeah.
It's the politicians making the decisions.
That goes nowhere.
Well, but I mean, yeah, the nature of a democracy is that elected politicians make the decisions. I mean, so the issue, it seems to me, is not that we should, you know, line them all up against a wall or take them to the ditch. It is that we want to try and inculcate a mindset that we did have 20 years ago, which is they're seriously constrained by evidence. They are seriously required to argue what they want to do and perhaps to experiment and do stuff gradually and rather slowly. You can't have a country run by technocrats, and indeed, in one sense, you know, the sort of backlash against globalism and maybe even, you know, the Brexit effect was a reaction by ordinary people to being told by people who'd spent 25 years in higher education and so on, no, you don't understand, and I frankly can't be bothered to explain it. So I do think the issue is not just, I mean, the issue is that the politicians really should be manoeuvred, I suppose, into having to listen, having to respond. Not that we should ditch them and just deal with technocrats.
Dominic Lawson said on the question time, he said that the problem is that the people who don't believe in Brexit don't understand that the argument isn't about economics.
Well, no, I think that is what Michael said. And to some extent that is true. As economists, we thought, oh, we know how to do all of this stuff. We're telling you it'll cost you 5% of GDP there. That will hurt. Now change your mind. And they didn't. But the point is, what we never, ever got in the referendum campaign, and really in the 2 years afterwards, was, you know what, we really want to do this, and it's going to cost you 5% of GDP. And that's the price. There just was never a price tag attached.
What about if you, so this is obviously insane, what about if you actually held the electorate accountable? So there obviously are about 48% of the population, maybe even 52, depending on who you count, really believe that sovereignty is worth anything.
Mm.
And then there are 48% of the people who think, actually, I'd rather have my travel and my money.
Mm.
If you made people sign a document saying, I am a Brexiteer, I am not a Brexiteer, then give them all sovereignty and tax them more to pay the other people who don't believe in it.
You sounded like an economist. Yes, everything has got a price. So that's clearly what we ought to do. We ought to set up an auction and see how much the 52 will stump up. I mean, you know, in some sense,
I think
that's
the
right.
Hedge funds have a lot of money behind them.
Yes, that's probably true. I mean, I think, yeah, in a sense, that's what the political process is supposed to do. The political process, I mean, not actually sort of saying we're going to tax you more, but the political process is supposed to be, you know, one in which we expect a sort of serious engagement from the electorate. The argument for representative democracy rather than direct democracy is precisely that this stuff is very complex, pretty boring most of the time, and actually almost the best thing that you can do is appoint someone to, as it were, do it on your behalf. And it is also the fact that if you have professional politicians, they have to compromise. An individual digs in over one thing and just doesn't have to compromise because it doesn't deal with all the rest. A professional politician has really to say it's NHS this week, it's Brexit the week after, it's foreign policy with Iran the week after. Now, which is the one I'm going to dig in over, which is the one I'm going
to
compromise?
It's great to say that politicians must compromise, and I absolutely agree that they should do. But if they're all compromising in line with whips, then it's not really much of a compromise. They're actually just voting with a single bloc, and that's less of a compromise, I reckon.
That depends really on the internal processes of the party. If the party has genuine discussion, I mean, the argument, for instance, about China is that, you know, China had a moderately open system in the sense that the Communist Party had 90 million people and that had quite a competition for ideas and policy. And similarly, if you think the political parties are capable of being broad churches which argue stuff out, then in a sense you might say, well, now, we do have to implement some stuff. Perhaps we all now ought to agree we're on the same side. So, you know, another complaint, since we've got that, the parties have become very much more extreme than they used to be, and much, much less able and willing to have these internal divisions and internal debates, which go on for years, traditionally.